Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week, meditation instructor Marcus Casey relates a story about the Mahamudra lineage. How did Mahamudra meditation become the main practice of our Kagyu tradition? This talk briefly covers the history of the Mahamudra lineage through reviewing the Mahamudra lineage prayer. Enjoy the podcast.
My name is Marcus Casey, and I'm a meditation instructor here at Columbus KTC. And when Lama Kathy and Lama Tom are not here, they have asked some of the meditation instructors to help out. So when that happens, we teach through a book by one of our lineage masters. And the book we're working through today is called Meditation, Advice to Beginners. And it's by one of the revered teachers in our lineage, Bokar Rinpoche. That book is actually out of print. We do have PDF copies if you want it. It's very clear, very concise, and we enjoy teaching from it. The book is called Meditation Advice to Beginners. But we're on the last chapter, next to last chapter, somewhere there. We're getting on up there, and it's his teaching in there is very clear, but it is a more advanced topic than some of what we've been working our way through to this point. So today we are going to be talking about Mahamudra meditation. And if you're fairly new, you may have heard the term Mahamudra, or you may not have heard the term Mahamudra, but even if you've been coming a while, you may not be familiar with what that is, or not sure what it means. So Mahamudra is considered the highest teaching in the Vajrayana. And when we're talking about Mahamudra, we're referring to one of two things. Either we're talking about the mind being about the ultimate nature of all beings or the ultimate nature of the mind, or we're talking about the meditation that leads us to realize that ultimate nature of the mind. Oh, I'm sorry. Was there no class? Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood. The word Mahamudra itself means the great seal or the great symbol. And so what we're talking about here is the ultimate nature of the mind. And let's talk about that for a minute. Think about your minds. Now, don't confuse your mind and your brain. Our teachers tell us that our brains are merely a temporary support for our minds. So don't confuse the two. Think only of the mind. Get away from the idea of the mind being the brain. And just think about these questions for just a second. What is the mind? Where is it? Is it in your body? Is it outside your body? Both? Neither? What color is it? What shape is it? How big is it? So when you think about these things, it becomes clear that we're not talking about a material thing when we're talking about our minds. It doesn't have any material characteristics at all. It is empty by nature. It's not a thing. So is it nothing? It's clear that it's not nothing, right? We know that it's not nothing because we can know. It's what does our knowing for us. It's how we know it isn't a thing. We have thoughts, and we know we have a mind because we have thoughts. It's not our brain. Even a corpse has a brain, but a corpse doesn't have a mind. And it doesn't really seem to have a location that we can point to. A lot of times teachers will say, if you think really hard and concentrate on another part of your body, it feels like your mind goes to that part of the body. It doesn't have a color, a shape, or a size. So the third Karmapa said in a prayer called the Aspiration Prayer of Mahamudra, he's talking about the mind here, and he says, not something, even the victors cannot see it. Not nothing, it is the ground of all samsara and nirvana. So what he's saying here is that even when the Buddhas look at the mind, its shape, its color, its location, they can't find it. And they're the all-knowing Buddhas. And yet, he says, it is the basis of samsara and nirvana. Now, what does that mean? If we contemplate our minds and how we perceive the world, we come to recognize that we never perceive this world apart from our minds. Samsara and nirvana are, samsara is the cycle of suffering we find ourselves in, and nirvana is the state of being liberated from that suffering. So where does that suffering come from, and where does that liberation come from? In both cases, the answer is our minds. All of our speech, all of our activity, our observations, our feelings, what we see, hear, taste, smell, and touch, all of that comes through our mind. It's almost as though we cannot distinguish or describe anything in any objective way, because we've never experienced anything in an objective way. We've never experienced anything apart from our subjective minds. So if our mind is the only way we experience the world, then it is the basis of all of our suffering, samsara, and it will be the basis of our liberation from suffering, nirvana. The mind is the ground of everything. Thinking about samsara or nirvana as a place is incorrect. We kind of tend to do that, don't we? We kind of tend to think of, well, I'm in samsara now, and at some point in the future, I'm going to be in nirvana. What we're really talking about, though, is the state of our minds. So at the beginning of our talks, we traditionally say the four-line refuge prayer together. The prayer's in Tibetan, so I understand there are a lot of you that may not know it. Feel free to just listen and make the aspiration that you will awaken and help others to awaken. When we are chanting this, we are repeating our commitment to take refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, or the goal, what we aspire to, the Dharma, or the path, and the Sangha, or the guides and companions on the path. So we'll repeat the refuge prayer a total of three times. Om Sangje Chidang Sogi Chognam La Jiang Chu Bardu Dai Ni Gap Su Chi Dagi Jin So Ji Pe So Nam Yi Dro La Pen Chir Sang Je Du Par Sho Sang Je Chu Dang So Ki Cho Nam La Chang Chu Bar Du Dai Ni Kyab Su Chi Dagi Jin So Ki Pe Su Nam Gi Dro La Pen Chir Sang Je Ju Par Sho Sang Je Chu Dang So Ki Cho Nam La Chang Chu Bar Du Dai Ni Kyab Su Chi Dagi Jin So Ki Pe Su Nam Gi Dro La Pen Chir Sang Je Du Par Sho. So the title of the chapter in the book by Bokar Rinpoche that we're studying today is The Legs, head and body of Mahamudra. And those of you who are familiar with the Mahamudra lineage prayer may recognize the metaphor that is being used here. It's a very important prayer in our lineage, and Bokar Rinpoche doesn't reference it directly, but it's clear it's the same pattern that he's following. So I've actually got some excerpts from that prayer that we can read. A few years ago, we actually did a book study of that prayer in our Sunday morning talks when the lamas weren't here. And the name of that book was Showing the Path of Liberation by Trungpa Rinpoche. And he went through that prayer. So the prayer starts with a verse that supplicates the masters of our lineage. And it's a little bit thick and hard to understand, but I'll read this verse here and then talk about it just briefly. It says, Great Vajradhara, Talopa Naropa, Marpa Milarepa, Lord of Dharma Gampopa, knower of the three times omniscient Karmapa, holder of the four great and eight lesser lineages, Drikung, Taklung, Tsalpa, these three, glorious Drukpa, and so on, masters of the profound path of Mahamudra, unequaled protectors of beings, the Dakpo Kagyu, I supplicate the Kagyu Lamas, grant your blessing that following your example, I hold your lineage. So there's a lot of words in there that you may not understand. The first section is names, and then the next section it talks about the names of lineages. And what it's talking about is the origin of the lineage of the Mahamudra teachings and then how it's been passed down to us. So it starts with Vajradhara, which is the primordial Buddha, and then to Talopa, an Indian Mahasiddha. And then it goes on to Naropa, Marpa. Marpa was known as a translator. He made trips to India and translated the teachings into Tibetan for Tibetans. So Marpa, Milarepa, Gampopa, and then Gampopa's student became the first Karmapa. And then the teachings have been passed down from Karmapa to Karmapa to Karmapa, so that our 17th Karmapa now is the lineage holder for these teachings. Bokar Rinpoche, who wrote our book, his root teacher is the 16th Karmapa, well, two, the 16th Karmapa and the first Kalu Rinpoche. So he's telling us that, you know, he's received these directly from the lineage, from where they come. It's a very important, and I won't get into it, but it's a very important thing to explain the lineage of how these teachings have come about, and to understand that what we're receiving here from Bokar Rinpoche are very authentic teachings that have been in this lineage for centuries, many centuries. So the next part then starts talking about the metaphor, the legs, head, and body of Mahamudra. And first he says that the practice of Mahamudra must bring three elements together. And it can be compared to the legs, head, and body of a person. Just like if your body were missing one section, your head, your midsection, or your legs, it would not be a complete body. What he's saying is that in order for Mahamudra practice to be complete and fully functional, it must contain all three of these. So in the lineage prayer, non-attachment are the legs of Mahamudra. Devotion is the head of Mahamudra. And meditation, also sometimes called non-distraction, is the body or trunk of Mahamudra. Bokar Rinpoche says, in order for the practice of Mahamudra to be effective, it must be complete. Head, legs, and trunk. If any of these are missing, it will not be genuine Mahamudra. In other words, we must have non-attachment, devotion, and meditation. So the legs, non-attachment. The lineage prayer says, non-attachment is the foot of meditation, as is taught. To this meditator who is not attached to food and wealth, who cuts the ties to this life, grant your blessings that I have no attachment to honor and gain. Now, this prayer says foot, and Bokar Rinpoche's text uses the word legs, but it's the same concept. And what it's saying is that, like legs or feet, non-attachment is what allows us to move forward in our practice. And if we are stuck in attachment, we are going to be stuck from moving forward in our practice as well. So once we free ourselves from that attachment, then our practice has legs and we can move forward. So where does attachment come from? Attachment comes from two basic mistakes we make in our thinking and in the way we view the world, the way we act in the world, incorrect habits. One is that we forget to see the world and everything in it as being impermanent. And so we attach to things that are inevitably impermanent and going to change. We attach to many things. We tend to take in all the phenomena, all the things we see, hear, feel, taste, touch. We take those in. We apply to them a permanence and a reality that they really don't have. Really, our minds are giving them a permanence and attributing them to them characteristics that they don't actually have. That's coming out of our thoughts and our emotions. And this is a mistake, and it's what causes us to grasp things. If we really had a firm understanding or realization of the changeability of everything around us, and this is harder, everyone around us, we wouldn't be so quick to grasp onto it if we really considered how that thing that we're attached to is going to change, it's going to fall apart. That person, the body I have, my own body, is going to fall apart. And yet we spend so much time treating these things as though they should not change, and then we suffer when they do. If you consider the building we're in, for example, it may look the same from week to week, but it's not. There are subtle changes. This building's over 100 years old. Consider the number of times it's been repaired in that 100 years, because things have just fallen apart and things continue to fall apart. We're right now looking at building a new building. After our fire, we had a building that was 90 years old, and a lot of things were falling apart, and some people in this room spent a lot of time working on fixing those things that were falling apart. And then it burned and was gone and was literally a hole in the ground within a week, right? I mean, sometimes things change faster than others. And our bodies today, I'm Marcus Casey. Yesterday I was Marcus Casey, and I think I'm going to be Marcus Casey tomorrow. But I think of myself as being the same Marcus Casey all the time. But the fact is, my mind is different. My body's different. They really change from instant to instant, and they are not the same as they were in the past. And if I look back 10 years, that's really obvious. Or 20, or 30, or 40. the further you look back, it's really obvious, right? And it's the same going forward in the future. And yet, how much of what we do is oriented on making our bodies happy making our bodies comfortable. And I'm not saying that's a wrong thing. But we tend to look at them as though they're not changing and as though they are permanent and will be here forever. So Bokar Rinpoche says it's even true of things that seem the most permanent and solid, like rocks and mountains and things like that. They seem very durable, but even those are in a constant state of change. And realizing this and internalizing this, developing thought patterns based on this, helps reduce our tendency to grab onto things which are transitory. And that's what the Buddha says is what causes us suffering. And that's also what causes our meditation to get stuck. So in addition to that, another way to decrease attachment is to develop a consciousness of the inherent suffering of the cycle of existence, or samsara, the state we find ourselves in now. Not only do we think of things as being permanent, we look at them and we look at people as having the capacity to actually bring us happiness. But Bokar Rinpoche says if we consider only the beings that populate the earth, we can verify a magnitude of continual suffering that afflicts them, physical as well as internal suffering. Now, we tend to wear masks, right? We tend to put on a mask and put on a face that says we're happy when actually we're suffering, we're going through things. So understanding that about yourself, consider that about everyone else that you're seeing. They're also doing the same thing. Driving to work, 270 or 70 or I-71, all those cars tomorrow morning that will be on the highway, everyone in those cars is doing so in an attempt to find happiness. We go to our jobs to make money, to make our lives comfortable, to get happiness, ultimately. Nothing wrong with that. I'll be right with everyone. You guys will be right with everyone, right? But we need to understand that that's not actually where our happiness comes from. Now, there are different types of suffering. Buddhists talk about three different types of suffering. The suffering of pain, or the suffering of suffering. That's the very blatant, obvious suffering that we all go through from time to time, that some people go through more than others. Animals go through it. All beings go through the suffering of suffering. Then what we were talking about earlier, the suffering of change. Because we are functioning in a world that is impermanent and things are always changing, whatever grasping we do is inevitably going to lead to suffering. And the third type of suffering is the suffering inherent in everything that is composed of elements, or all-pervasive suffering, we call it. So this being the case, no being caught in the cycle of samsara knows a state of genuine happiness. Sounds depressing, right? But it's reality, and developing the ability to face the reality of suffering motivates us. Bhavkar Rinpoche says, from the moment we understand that all external and internal phenomena are impermanent, that they are stained by suffering, and that samsara is no longer interesting, our attachment to the appearances of this life diminishes. From then on, we can turn toward the methods of liberation that allow us to attain Buddhahood. So, moving on from non-attachment, which are the legs of Mahamudra practice, devotion is the head of meditation. I'm working on tough topics this Sunday. So, spiritual depth requires devotion. And let me repeat that. Spiritual depth requires devotion. The monotheistic religions put a huge premium on devotion, devotion to God. And in the West, people who come to Buddhism often come because they have a strong attraction to spirituality, but they're searching for something that works for them. Maybe something that they weren't, that didn't work for them in their previous religious experience, they weren't able to reconcile with an analytical or scientific mind or something like that. So I understand that then there can be a nervousness when you come to Buddhism, and then we start talking about something that may be outside of the comfort zone. So that's perfectly understandable. And if that's where you are, that's fine. Work with where you are. Take what works for you and use it to move forward in your practice right now. But be careful not to use that comfort zone as an excuse not to stretch or try out new things. So for some people, that stretch may be devotion, because Buddhism has that too. Devotion helps us to lay down our egos that tend to want to treat ourselves as the center of the universe. And instead, you develop a humble reverence or enthusiastic respect toward those with realization, those further down the path. Those who have already gone where we want to go. And Bokha Rinpoche says that the object of our devotion should be the masters of this lineage, especially those that we call the Source Lama, or the teacher who introduces us directly to the nature of our own mind. But it does more than help us lay down our own egos. Devotion opens us to the grace or blessings of the teacher. In other words, by opening to a teacher who has great accumulations of merit, we get a boost. Bokha Rinpoche goes so far as to say that without devotion and blessings that come from our teachers through devotion, the realization of Mahamudra is impossible. And devotion is the head of Mahamudra. The lineage prayer says, devotion is the head of Mahamudra as is taught. The guru opens the gate to the treasury of oral instructions. To this meditator who continually supplicates you, grant your blessings so that uncontrived devotion be born within. There are many metaphors to explain how this mechanism of devotion and blessings works. So Bokha Rinpoche compares the grace of the teacher to a snow-covered mountain, and the devotion of the student to the sun that shines on the mountain and melts the snow, and then you can get water. Without the warmth of the sun, you're not going to melt the snow, and you're not going to get water. And the snow, and we won't receive the indispensable grace, is what he says. So another metaphor for that is that our teacher's compassion for us is like a hook, and our devotion is a ring that allows the hook of compassion to attach to us and pull us, in the words of Kali Rinpoche, from happiness and then to awakening. Another way, another metaphor that's used is to look at the teacher as like a radio tower on a hill, always broadcasting. And through devotion, we're able to tune in to that broadcast and receive that energy. We turn toward our teachers, and what they are is reflected in who we are. Now, the third part of Mahamudra meditation is meditation or non-distraction. So we have non-attachment to the cycle of existence, and the wish to liberate ourselves from it are the feet. Devotion is the head, and we need to reach the third point, the meditation that contemplates the nature of the mind. So this meditation requires knowledge of how to position the body and how to position the mind. We talk a lot about posture. We have, especially in this book, Boka Rinpoche includes it in probably 5 or 6 of the chapters. He has sections on posture. We teach it every Sunday in our Intro to Meditation course, and it's because there is an interdependence between the stability of our body and our ability to relax and create a stable mind. So, in short, we have our legs crossed in the Vajra position, right foot on left thigh and left foot on right thigh, or in any of the modifications that allow us to be both relaxed and stable at the same time. Like I am now, I don't know if you can see it, both of my feet are resting on the cushion, and this, for me, is what works and is comfortable. Some people do it in a chair. There are many different ways to do it, but the two principles are relaxed but stable. Hands resting in the Maha Mudra of meditation, a straight spine, shoulders open, chin tucked in slightly, tongue on the roof of the mouth, and relaxed lips, and the eyes resting gently in space and resting downward a little bit. So then we need to position our minds for meditation. How do we settle our minds? The first thing we notice when we start to meditate is all of our thoughts. And we have thoughts about the past. We have thoughts about the future. And they are continuously arising in our minds. To settle the mind, we stop following these thoughts about the past or future. We rest our minds in the present as it is. Remain without distraction in the mind. And this is Maha Mudra meditation. The lineage prayer says, non-distraction is the body of meditation as is taught. Whatever arises is fresh, the nature of thought. To the meditator who rests simply without altering it, grant your blessing that meditation is free from conception. Now, some people think that meditating like this without entertaining any thoughts of the past or the future is difficult, or even some might have a fear of it, or might find themselves being pulled into, oh, but I really need to think this thought, you know? Oh, that's about work. I'm about to go to work. I need to follow this thought through. And that's a very common thing to do. Boka Rinpoche says, if the mind ceases to project itself onto that which has been or onto that which will be and rests as it is in the present, open and relaxed, it will have a feeling of rest which makes meditation easy and pleasant. So when meditation isn't easy and pleasant, we might find ourselves resisting to resting completely in the present. And it's useful to think about this. Maybe it's things of the past that we can't let go of. Maybe you have anxieties about the future. When you examine these mindfully, you'll find that you have attachment there. And that's how these all work together. That's why non-attachment is the foot of meditation. If you're sitting down to meditate and being in the present and you find yourself constantly pulled, what you're finding is there's a root there of attachment. And it arises from the mistaken belief that samsara will make us happy, and the trust that things are really as they seem to be or as they appear to us. So if you find that happening, really think for a while. Outside of your meditation, contemplate, am I expecting this world of suffering to make me happy? Am I creating a reality for things that isn't really how things are? So we can take that difficult emotion or difficult relationship or difficult situation, difficult memory, whatever it is that's trying to pull us out of the present moment and into the future or the past, and we can use that to dig deeper and get at the root of attachment. So when we rest our minds in the natural state, in the present, open and relaxed, with a relaxed body and inner non-distraction, the mind will, for a moment, remain still and without thoughts. And we can call that being the still mind. At other times, thoughts will arise. And we can say that the mind is moving when we have a lot of thoughts going. So we have a still mind and a moving mind. So when we have a still mind, we recognize it and rest in that state. When thoughts arise and when the mind starts moving, we should also recognize that in the same way. What we shouldn't do is consider that our thoughts are bad and try to stop creating thoughts. That's one extreme. And the other extreme is seeing those thoughts and following them. So those are the two things we tend to do wrong with thoughts. The nature of thought and the nature of our minds is the same. And thoughts are going to arise from our minds. And if we neither follow them nor try to suppress them or feel bad when they arise, then we can just let them flow right back into our minds and understand that this moving mind is also part of the nature of our minds. So we tend to judge our meditation as well based on this, don't we? If we have a really good meditation, it's one where we were able to stay really focused and not a lot of thoughts came up. And if thoughts came up and we followed those thoughts a lot, then we say we had a bad meditation. But that's not really true. The muscle you're strengthening when you meditate is that muscle of awareness and mindfulness that recognizes when you are catching yourself following a thought and drops it and returns to the resting state. That's the muscle you're working. So the more times you're able to catch yourself and return, the more times you're creating a habit that allows you the space from your thoughts to drop the thoughts that try to get you off track and return. So Mahamudra meditation is the mind settled in the present. The important point of meditation, Boka Rinpoche says, is not the absence of thought, but maintaining a non-distracted vigilance without judgment and free of the notions of good or bad. The lineage prayer says, the nature of thought is Dharmakaya, as is taught. Nothing whatsoever, it arises as everything. To this meditator for whom all arises as unceasing play, grant your blessings that I realize samsara and nirvana as inseparable. So Mahamudra meditation is the body of a complete and genuine practice of Mahamudra. Non-attachment, devotion, and a meditative mind resting in the present as it is without distraction, without refusing anything, and without accepting anything. So, before we open it up for questions, I mentioned earlier that Mahamudra is the highest teaching in the Vajrayana, but I want to offer a little word of warning or a little caveat. We tend to approach spiritual practice with the same confusion that we bring to the rest of our lives. And for many people, that translates into the pitfall of spiritual materialism. So some people hear that this is the highest practice in the Kagyu lineage and say, that's for me. I don't want to waste my time with anything else. Why would I want to do something other than the best? The truth is, the highest practice is the one we are doing, the one we're doing now. Especially if you're working with a teacher who is working with you for a practice that works for you right now, getting ahead of yourself is not going to be beneficial. The metaphor I kind of think of when I think of this, and it's because I have a good track record in this. Before I came to Columbus, and before I moved to Columbus and started coming to KTC and connected with Lama Kathy, when I first started attending a Buddhist center, I had not taken refuge. I had never had a Lama interview and talked about my practice. And I was reading books on Mahamudra meditation because I heard it was the highest practice, right? I think of it like sandpaper. So Mahamudra meditation may be the finest grit sandpaper. It may be what gives it that final polish and is very high. But if you're working with a really rough piece of wood, that's not going to do you any good. You need the rough stuff at that point, right? And that's what you need at that time. So just like there are different grits of sandpaper for different jobs, there are different meditations that work for our minds at different points. And so the getting ahead of yourselves, it's not that this teaching is super secret or that it's off limits to you or something like that. It's that we need to be ready for it to be an effective practice for us. In our lineage, we have a series of foundational practices for approaching Mahamudra. And this is called Nundro. And some of you in this room are Nundro practitioners. Nundro is a series of four practices. We do one at a time, completing a certain number of repetitions of each one before we move on to the next one. The first is a practice of refuge and bodhicitta. The second is a purification practice. The third practice is a practice of offerings. And the fourth practice is guru yoga. And then at the end, the teacher gives the instructions necessary to do Mahamudra practice. But this series of practices for us in our busy lives is one that takes most of us years to complete. Even in retreat, in three-year retreat, when it is done full-time, and I do mean full-time, morning to night, 7 days a week, it takes months. So this is, it's a long period of preparation for Mahamudra practices. Nundro is a wonderful practice and a valuable practice. And because it takes so long and requires so much of us, from us, it tends to expose the confusions and wrong motivations that we bring to it. So if we come to it with an ambitious mind, with a mind that says, I want to get to the higher and higher teachings, that spiritual materialism, rather than the motivation of practicing for the benefit of all beings, and to try to wake up to benefit all beings, we're going to run into that brick wall pretty head on when we practice a long and involved practice like Nundro. And again, that's speaking from experience. So keep working with the practices you're on and understand the progression that leads to more and more practices. Work with Lama Kathy and Lama Tom. I encourage you to sign up for interviews when they have them and really work on getting the practice that works for you and then go back to them and keep updating that from time to time so that you can keep progressing down this path. So we have time for questions. We have a question microphone. If anyone wants to ask a question or make a comment, I will do my best to respond. All right. Well, I guess everyone understands Mahamudra then. Perfect. All right. Let's dedicate the merit of being here today and listening to Bokar Rinpoche's teaching. And I'm going to end by reading the English translation of the dedication of merit from the Nundro practice. I dedicate this virtue that all beings without exception be granted the state of Buddhahood, that they may travel the inner path to the Vajra mind, a non-dying, ever blissful union of wisdom and skillful means. By this merit, may I quickly realize Mahamudra. Having realized, may I establish all beings without a single exception in such a state. Through the blessings of the Buddhas who attained the three kayas, through the blessings of the unchanging truth of Dharmata, through the blessings of the unwavering intention of the Sangha, may this dedication and aspiration become fulfilled. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. For more information about the Columbus Karma Taksim Choling, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music on this podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.